UN climate talks at COP26 had many of us enthralled over 2 weeks of international negotiations and dramatic demonstrations on the streets of Glasgow. I'm Caroline Kenyon, and in this Innovation Agency podcast, we hear the insights of an academic helping to lead his university in addressing the challenges of climate change, and his tips for other organisations setting out on a journey to sustainability. Hello, welcome to the Innovation Agency podcast, Professor John Whitten. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And you are a director of the University of Central Lancashire Centre for Sustainable Transitions. Tell me, first of all, what that role means and also how you came to get that role.
Well, I've been at the university for probably about 10 years in total, but I've not always been at UCLan. So I came from industry. So I was an environmental scientist in consultancy, in engineering consultancy, in environmental consultancy. And then I started working for the National Nuclear Laboratory. And I was there for about 13 years in total. And I did everything from ground investigations of contaminated land to big decision-making projects. So how to decommission plants, bringing experts together and helping them make decisions. So I had quite a varied career at the NNL. And then I came to UCLan to manage an industrial project that they had. It was a cross-industry university project where industry was funding research at the university. And they felt they needed somebody from industry with a research background to help manage that project and to help discuss the project between the industrial partners and the academic partners. So I came to actually do that on a secondment, a two-year secondment. I was never staying. I was always going to go back. And I was quite happy with that. I enjoyed my job in industry. I was quite happy to go back. But I did stay. I was offered a job as a principal lecturer at UCLan, but on the research side. So I started to run groups of researchers looking at sustainability, climate change, specifically energy and energy transitions. And I did that for quite a few years. And then I became a professor in 2019. So I now run a Centre for Sustainable Transitions, and I'm also a director of the Institute of Citizenship, Society and Change. So quite a mixed career that's landed me at UCLan.
And that's also taken you to COP26, hasn't it?
It has.
So you've got to tell us about that. What were you doing there, and what was that experience like?
That was an interesting experience. I was asked to go to COP26 by the university, who in turn had been asked by the Lancashire LEP, the Lancashire Enterprise Partnership, would somebody go to represent the university, particularly around sustainability and climate change. So they asked me to go. I went to a side event at COP that the Metro Mayors, so Andy Burnham, Steve Rotherham, had organised, and it was specifically about engaging young people in climate change. And that's an interest dear to my heart, because that's quite a few of the projects that I work on at UCLan and do research on. So that was one reason for going to COP. The other reason was also to meet some of the delegates at COP. We work with the Kenyan government and the Kenyan Forestry Service, and we work on projects in Kenya where we work with communities in Nairobi who are going through the transition from forestry occupations, specifically deforestry occupations, to non-timber forestry occupations. They still live in the forest, but if we are asking people to stop cutting down trees, we need to offer them alternative livelihoods. So we work with, and we've been working with those people for probably a couple of years. They just happened to be at COP as part of the government delegation from Kenya, and they were very keen to meet, and so was I. So I spent Thursday with the meeting I've just talked about, but I spent most of Friday with the Kenyan delegation talking about all things climate change in Kenya. So that was fantastic.
And that's an opportunity to meet them in person. Presumably, yes. Over the last 18 months or more, you've not actually met them. Have you met them at all? Or was this the first time?
No, we've probably, like the rest of the world, we've done everything on Zoom or Teams. We've had a project with Kenya. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Kenyan government. We got funding from GCRF, from the government's fund. And we carried out a project where the Brits should have actually gone to Kenya, but we couldn't do that. So fortunately, the Kenyan Forestry Service have a strong team, and they did a lot of the work. And everything we did on Zoom. which was incredibly frustrating. But hopefully we've now got another project for this coming year where we will go to Kenya. Hopefully things will be a little bit better for us and we can do that.
So how did it feel being at a real event with real people and lots of them?
It was quite interesting. I was apprehensive because who wants to be in a room full of people at the moment? But actually, because the rules in Scotland require you to wear masks indoors, everybody did that. Everybody observed social distancing. It was very hygienic. I felt quite safe. And the venues were nice and big as well. You were not in small spaces. These were very large, airy venues. So everything was done really well. It was a great experience. Yeah.
And what do you think of the results and the outcomes of COP26? Can you comment on what happened?
I'm still processing a lot of that. I was getting live updates from my friends who were actually in COP. I was getting, you know, every time a draft agreement was issued, I was getting that live on WhatsApp. I think there's some very good things happened at COP. You know, we've now recognised firmly that the upper limits should be 1.5 degrees of global heating. That's now enshrined from Paris. It's now in the Glasgow Pact, which is fantastic. Countries are now recognising that we have to decarbonise. That's great. We did a lot of very good work around coal. I know that's been in the press, the change in terminology around coal. But still, fossil fuels are recognised as a massive contributor to climate change. The conference recognised that. And next year, when parties meet again, I'm sure they'll be talking about coal. So I think, am I frustrated? Absolutely frustrated. I don't think I've ever been more frustrated than when I was coming home from COP. But then when you start to process it and you start to think about it, you know, you're talking best part of 200 countries here trying to agree something by consensus. I don't think there's anything else like it. You have to take that into account. Very good stuff around reducing methane emissions. That was fantastic. Good stuff around protecting forestry and forests. So a lot of good things. Frustratingly slow progress, hardly surprising. And we are still heading for above 1.5 degrees temperature rise. We're still heading for that. So there's a lot more work needs to be done. But I think some of the relationships I was encouraged by, particularly the relationship between the US and China, I thought the announcement, the surprise announcement of cooperation was fantastic. We all know that if China decide to do something very meaningful on climate change, it will change the world almost overnight. And the US. So that was incredibly encouraging. Yeah.
And you went to that event hosted by our Metro mayors in Manchester and Liverpool City region. Do you think that reflects the Northwest taking a leading role in this? It reflects the importance of it to our Metro mayors?
I was really, really encouraged by that. I've got to say, I mean, Andy Byrne and Steve Rotherham, they work well together. It's clear they have a relationship. They work incredibly well together. They announced at the meeting that they would be holding a youth assembly or a youth event where they would bring young people together to talk about all the issues around climate change. They will fund that as well. Now, that is leadership. That's saying, not only are we talking about this, we'll put some money towards it. Now, that to me is leadership. And that was fantastic to see. I expect the regional LEPs will be involved in that as well. Lancashire certainly want to be involved in that. So I was very encouraged by that, really. And of course, both mayors are doing a lot around transport. You know, Andy Burnham's got his clean zone in Manchester, clean air zone in Manchester. So that's leadership. It's happening. So I'd say the Northwest is leading, which I think is appropriate given the industrial heritage of the Northwest. I think it's absolutely what we should be doing. Yeah.
And leadership and sustainability is one of the topics you're particularly interested in, isn't it? So because it is about behaviour change, isn't it? It's not just about things you sign up to. It's how you make people do it. So, but how do you even go about that? How do you influence leadership in sustainability?
I think, you know, I always look at this in two quite different ways. That we have, how do we influence our leaders? That's one question. How do we influence then our citizens? That's another question. And I think the two need quite different approaches. I mean, we've seen the frustration on the streets, particularly from our young people, at the void of leadership around climate change, not just nationally, but internationally. There's an avoidance of the issue. Of course there is. You know, there's big business interests. There's the business as usual narrative. Our leaders need to be influenced. They need to know that it is not okay to carry on with business as usual. They're getting that message. I'm sure they're getting that message. Some leaders are more proactive than others, but I would say on the whole, they're absolutely getting that message. But then how do we influence our citizens? And that is, for me, a much harder problem. You know, this is the everybody else. This is the minority who might be interested in climate change, but the vast majority who, not that they're not interested, but just that they have very busy lives and they're getting on with those lives. I think we have to normalise a lot of the things that we're doing to adapt to climate change, because again, there's adaption and then there's prevention. We've already seen a 1.1 degree rise in global temperatures, so adaption is necessary, particularly in developing countries. We have to normalise a lot of the technologies that we have. So for example, the construction industry, classic example. Why aren't we just building in technologies into our houses? Solar panels as roof tiles, fantastic insulation, ground source heat pumps. Well, it's cost. Of course it's cost. But I think there needs to be more imagination around this. I think market-led solutions will take you so far, but we need strong government in some of these areas, particularly when it comes to influencing the construction industry, I think. So it's a multifaceted approach. It's human behaviour, but it's also policy, tools and government that need to actually influence this agenda.
So at UCLAN, you've declared a climate emergency, 2 years ago. What does that mean? Because you've declared that emergency, does that mean you're going to take urgent action? What does it practically involve?
Well, it does really, doesn't it? I mean, an emergency in any other situation, a health emergency means ambulance, drastic action, A&E. I see that parallel with the climate. I think it was important to declare a climate emergency at UCLAN, as others have done, of course, because it demonstrates a commitment from the university to do something. And that actually, I just talked there about influencing leadership. And the leadership was influenced. We have a standing meeting at UCLAN called the Professoriat, where all the professors meet to talk about the big issues, about research predominantly, but how the university is run, how the university manages research. And the climate emergency dominated that meeting. So we approached the university and said, as a professoriat, we absolutely think you have to do something about this. And we also convened the NHS leaders who were also doing work on climate change, climate adaption within the NHS in the Lancashire region. And we convened them at the university to talk about this issue. And it was at that meeting that the leaders of UCLAN declared a climate emergency. They did it very publicly. So I think that's a good example of a little bit of persuasion, a little bit of presenting the university as a university that does want to do something on climate change. And leverage is a very useful tool, isn't it? And I think you have to do all these things. It's not confrontational. It's just sometimes pointing the way for our leaders to do the right thing. And we did that at UCLAN, and it's been so far quite successful. We have a working group that I sit on around the climate emergency. And that has part of the leadership team from the university also sit on that group, together with the directors of facilities, because facilities are a massive part of anything that we do. And we're doing some quite basic steps at the moment. So, for example, the UCLAN campus is, you know, some of the buildings are over 100 years old. So are those buildings state-of-the-art, adapted for climate change? Of course not. Of course not. And they've undergone modifications throughout the years. So we're getting to understand our estate. What buildings do we have on the estate? What buildings need significant amount of work doing on them to make them suitable for a climate emergency? So that's one of the things that we're doing. There's some very practical issues around the electricity grid in Preston and at UCLAN. So if you want to know how much energy is being used in a building, you'd think, very obvious. We just look at a meter. No, 1 meter for multiple buildings. So actually, we're doing something about that, and we're upgrading our monitoring system at UCLan. We're also developing a system where we can map the infrastructure at UCLan. So if we do close a building because we need to do work on it, what does that mean for student lectures? Have we got enough capacity at the university to put on the lectures that we need for students? We still have to deliver for students, even though we're doing a lot of infrastructure work in Preston, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have seen, new developments. We still have to keep the whole campus running, which is a massive challenge. So it's putting these very basic things in place. You often start conversations with, we need to reduce our energy consumption. Nobody would disagree with that because, of course, it saves money. And these are the easy things to do. I think it gets much, much harder when you start having the conversation, how do we talk to our staff about the travel? How do we talk to staff about modes of transport, about parking on campus? How do we talk to our staff about all these things? That's where we're heading towards now, and I think that's going to be the very, very difficult stuff. We've already taken all our parking off campus. We've already done that. There's a real issue with traffic on campus. It's city centre campus. We've already done some of these things, but I think those conversations now are just going to get harder and harder and harder. And that, for me, is where the real challenges start to happen. Yeah.
Because that's individual behaviour then, isn't it? Individual behaviour. Not institutional actions. It's right down to the individual.
That's right.
So all the international travel that professors like yourself would be invited to conferences in very exotic parts of the world, that wouldn't be easy, would it, to say no more of that?
No, it's not. And I mean, you know, I get asked this a lot around my own behaviour, even down to the clothes I wear and the shoes I wear. And students can be very, very challenging on that. And they're right to do so. You know, there's nothing worse than hypocrisy, so none of us like that. But I think, you know, I went through a period where I was doing an awful lot of travelling. You know, I wouldn't say over my career I've done a ridiculous amount, but I was doing a lot. And I thought, what can I do? So, for example, if you're going to anywhere on mainland Europe, there's no excuse. You should not be flying. There's no need to fly. So I spent a lot of time on trains. And that's a joy, actually, you know, because you can work on the train. You can think about, well, if I'm going to, you know, Paris, that's a very easy journey, very easy journey. So there are ways that you can, you know, reduce your CO2 emissions personally at work. You know, if you get invited to a meeting in America, there's no other way but to fly. Do I need to go? Do I need to go? And there was an experience in lockdown, of course, through COVID. We've seen that you don't really always need to go. So we had a conference at Penn State University. They couldn't do that because of COVID. So it was, instead of having it over 2 days, they had very short meetings over the course of a year. They changed the agenda and that worked really well. It worked extremely well. So you had there probably over 100 people who didn't fly. So it can be done. And I think particularly around conferencing, I think, you know, virtual conferencing is now mainstream. You know, it was less so before. It was always, the onus was always to congregate in person. And I think there is a place for that. Don't get me wrong. I think there is a place for that. But I think a lot of conferences in particular could be done remotely. I like that because it means I can spend more time with my family. I don't have to go away for a week. Let's face it, if you go to the States, you spend probably 2 or 3 days out of that week travelling. So it's a much more effective use of time as well. Yeah.
So in the NHS, we want to achieve a green NHS, reduce carbon. Mm. Obviously, there are a lot of old buildings in the NHS, so that's a first step. But what advice would you give in terms of leading towards a green NHS? What are the important lessons that you might share from your own experience?
I think one thing, you know, we've had for a long, long time, ever since Local Agenda 21 in the early 90s in local authorities, we've had environmental champions, environmental leaders. We've kind of done all that. And I think there is a place for that, but it has to have senior leadership support. And that support has to be visible. So for an example I always use is if you go into any sort of industrial situation, you have health and safety. And for decades now, we have known that if you talk about health and safety, you regularly train people on health and safety, that your accidents decrease. We've known that for decades, and it works. It's worked in the chemical industry, nuclear industry, in aviation. We know that. But one thing that is very clever around health and safety is that even the most junior staff are trained to challenge the most senior staff on health and safety. And, you know, my own experience has been you can even go to a director, you can say, I don't think carrying a cup of coffee up the staircase is a great idea. And that senior leader will say, you're absolutely right. They'll respond constructively to that criticism. There won't be any threat to your career. And actually, the individual who might be a junior employee feels quite empowered around that. It really is quite empowering. And I think we can learn a lot from that sort of approach. I think we can have a system of observation, of challenge around the things in organisations that are negative behaviour when it comes to the climate. You don't want a situation where colleagues are, you know, gossiping about colleagues. Of course you don't want that. But I think, again, with some imagination, I think we could have training programmes around climate positive behaviour, for example, where colleagues are actively encouraged to do things that are good for the climate, good for facilities. And I know whenever you have an ageing infrastructure, of course it's difficult. It is very difficult. But I think when maintenance rebuilds are actually carried out, that's when you obviously do the updating. Perhaps some of those buildings can be retrofitted. I know a lot can't, just because of the state of them. But I think training programs around climate positive behavior, an active system of reporting and challenge, I think that those are some of the ways, and full engagement with the leadership of organizations. I think that is so essential. Many folks in organizations almost look for permission from the senior leadership team. Can I say this? Will it be taken in a bad way? Well, if it's normalized within that organization, then you can say it and there will be no criticism. And it's very much in that. You have obviously a bottom-up situation where a lot of this stuff needs to happen, but you have a top-down as well. You have that permission from the senior leadership that it's okay to say certain things, it's okay to challenge, and we'd quite like you to do that.
And that resonates with me because in the NHS, we have freedom to speak up guardians. You know, to keep our patients safe, we need staff to feel enabled to challenge somebody who's about to do the wrong thing, you know. So, that resonates. But to apply that then to sustainability is an interesting idea. So, thank you for that. So what's where are you on your journey at UCLan? What are your next steps? You mentioned challenging behaviours. Do you have any sort of grand plan, or is it simply an ongoing campaign of culture change?
I think there's certainly, well, as many folks will have seen, there's grand plans around the campus, the facilities themselves. We have some modern buildings. We have some very, very old buildings. We're going through a process of refurbishment and retrofit. And that's really the very big next stage, I think, for UCLan. We're also seeing, I talked there about the metering of buildings and how we monitor energy use in particular. That's already happening now at UCLan. We've been buying our energy from renewable sources for a decade plus at UCLan. We've been doing that for a very long time. And I think probably something we do need to look at very carefully is divesting from fossil fuels. You know, we know that many of our pension funds, many of our investments are actually invested in fossil fuels, in fossil fuel industry. That's just how the system works. I think we have to really push for divestment out of those funds. That, to me, we've seen at COP how finance is so important, how signalling around finance is incredibly important. If you signal to investors that actually putting your money in fossil fuels probably isn't the best idea you can have, they won't do that. That then sets about the demise, quite naturally, of fossil fuel investments. I think we really have to look at finance and where our money is, where our investments are, and then get them out of those fossil fuel funds. And I think that is a huge challenge, but it can be done. Other universities have done it, so it can be done. So as well as the very practical facility-based issues, there's also the financial side. I think a lot more could be done with students. So we are now looking at how do we include climate change sustainability as a core part of our curriculum. So whatever course you do at UCLan, how can we include these issues? We're looking at that. The staff behaviour, I think we've done an awful lot around COVID, that we had to do it. So that's great because we now know we can do it. And I think that will probably come a little bit later. It's really important at UCLan and other universities that our students see the staff. It's incredibly important. Having a campus where everybody works remotely, that just doesn't work. It doesn't work for student experience. It doesn't work for a lot of staff, actually. I love being in the university. You talk to colleagues, you talk to students. You know, I have PhD students that I need to see. But I think there is an issue around staff travel, as I've already said. So I think how can we encourage staff to do the right things when it comes to particularly international conferences? Research is global. That's just the way research is and the way it should be. You know, I work with probably more people outside the UK than I do inside the UK. But I think we can work much more smartly. Instead of just going to that meeting in the States, we can do it remotely. So quite a lot to go at. And I think, where are we on that journey? We're probably just getting started. We've done an awful lot, but it's almost the work that needs to be done before you can start the real job. And I think a lot of organisations are probably feeling the same. Yeah.
And you were frustrated coming away from COP. Are you still frustrated or do you feel hopeful? For your children, you've got children. Do you think in the future things will look very different?
I feel hopeful because the good thing about COP is that it's front and centre in the news, in the media. And one thing that does is, you know, I've spent quite a lot of time. Last week I spoke at two community groups who'd asked me specifically to go and talk to them about climate change. I don't think that would have happened without COP. So again, we're now normalising some of these issues. I am hopeful. I've got to be hopeful. I don't think I'm given a choice. I think, would it be easier to say, there's no point, we can't achieve this? Of course it would. I'm not negative by nature, but I think we have to be positive. We've got to embrace hope in general, but specifically around climate change, because I think, you know, that you hear this narrative, and it's a bit of a cliche now, that our children are the future. If they see us hopeful and they see us positive, they are much more likely to want to support the efforts, I think. My children ask me all the time about climate change, all the time, and they get quite distressed sometimes about what they see on TV, what they see in the news. So I think, you know, there is a responsibility not only to do something, but also to support the next generation. Andy Burnham said something very, very interesting at the meeting I went to. And he said that the best thing that politicians can do, and he did talk about politics being in a little bit of a mess, but he said the best thing we can do is to make sure that by the time the younger generation come into power, the structures that they need to achieve what they will need to do are actually in place and they work and they're not broken. I think the way he kind of got that responsibility across was a very powerful message. I like that a lot. It was leadership. It's not good enough to just say we're doing things. It's not good enough, actually, to do some things. We have to make sure the systems, processes and governance are absolutely appropriate for what needs to be done. That's a huge job, I think. And that's something that particularly local government and national government need to do and need to do soon.
It's great. So we'll end on a note of hope. Thank you.
That's okay.
Thank you very much, Professor John Whitton. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And we'll add links on our podcast page to further resources or reading.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks to Professor John Whitton of the University of Central Lancashire. There are useful links on our podcast page to find out more about the work on sustainability at UCLAN. And please follow and share our podcast so more people can hear about innovations and inspirational individuals. Thank you for listening.